So welcome. We are looking at the 17th chapter, the Divine Birth and Divine Works. We're roughly midway through it. And we're going to enter into somewhat lengthy discussion of the term Dharma and what it means in the context of the Gita. Sri Aurobindo continues with this paragraph. We must then, in order to understand the Gita's description of the work of the avatar, take the idea of the Dharma in its fullest, deepest, and largest conception as the inner and outer law by which the divine will and wisdom work out the spiritual evolution of mankind and its circumstances and results in the life of the race. Dharma, in the Indian conception, is not merely the good, the right, morality and justice, ethics. It is the whole government of all the relations of man with other beings, with nature, with God, considered from the point of view of a divine principle working itself out in forms and laws of action. Forms of the inner and the outer life, orderings of relations of every kind in the world. And there's a footnote. The word dharma means holding, from the root dhar, to hold. Dharma is both that which we hold to and that which holds together our inner and outer activities. In its primary sense, it means a fundamental law of our nature which secretly conditions all our activities. And in this sense, each being, type, species, individual, group, has its own dharma. Secondly, there is the divine nature which has to develop and manifest in us. And in this sense, dharma is the law of the inner workings by which that grows in our being. Thirdly, there is the law by which we govern our outgoing thought and action and our relations with each other so as to help best both our own growth and that of the human race towards the divine ideal. So if you've studied Indian philosophy and its religious history, India has a very rich concept here. It stems, perhaps, from the concept of Ritta in the Rig Veda. Ritta, as we've spoken about before in our study of the life divine, is the ordering power of truth. So if there is true being, to use Vedantic terminology, we would be regarding true being as sat. As true being acts, it becomes truth, satya. Ritta is the correct and right action of truth. It is an ordering principle at the cosmic level, and it is an ordering principle at our level. It is the truth consciousness at work, creating a cosmos out of the stuff of primordial being. So dharma, in the Vedic context, we get the hint, is an aspect by which Ritta affects itself in universal action. So Rutta is at the core. It is the essence creating truth. Dharma is an executive power that goes forward and installs it in action at the cosmic level, but also in individuals, in social patterns, in the governance of the processes of nature. Dharma is executing the secret will expressed in Rutta. So we see echoes of this here in what Sri Aurobindo is writing. He's explaining to us all of this because of the early section in chapter 4 in the Gita, where Krishna is giving voice to why he comes as the avatar. Why does he descend? And there's a reference to uphold the Dharma, the Sanatana Dharma. But for Sri Aurobindo, this is the outside of the argument. There's an interior argument. And you'll see as he works through these elements, whether we're talking about the cosmic order, or the social order, or the individual order, and how we connect with the three great terms of being that will throw this concept of Dharma into sharp relief for us. So it's Dharma is what we hold to. It holds things together. It's an aspect of the divine nature. And it's the law by which we govern self personally, and then the larger collective self. By the way, to go back to the Vedic context for a moment, we get most of our references to Rita, Dharma, when we look at the two powerful gods, Varuna and Mitra. Varuna represents something oceanic, vast. In fact, the Veda speaks that there are never two people alone together talking and discussing, because always there is a third, and the third is Varuna, the all-seeing, who is present, and he's serious about acting according to nature, because he's trying to govern the universe and make it all cohere. So if you don't act according to Dharma, you will be acting according to adharma, what is against. We'll see this in Sri Aurobindo's essay in a few paragraphs. So Varuna is very serious, but Varuna is complemented by Mitra, the spirit of love and friendship, and you also see them together. So something may be big, but it gets down to your level as well. It finds a place for you in amity and concord within the whole. We must maintain the whole order, but there's a place for every individual within it if they live according to the truth inside them. And the Dharma is there to help you do that, expressing the right way to make Rita real, if I may say it that way. So, back to Sri Aurobindo's essay now. Dharma is generally spoken of as something eternal and unchanging. And so it is in the fundamental principle, in the ideal, but in its forms, it is continually changing and evolving, because man does not already possess the ideal or live in it, but aspires more or less perfectly towards it, is growing towards its knowledge and practice. So, chapter 14, Shloka 27, and chapter 11, 18. And in this growth, Dharma is all that helps us to grow into the divine purity, largeness, light, freedom, power, strength, joy, love, good, unity, beauty, and against it, stands its shadow and denial. All that resists its growth and has not undergone its law, all that has not yet yielded up and does not will to yield up its secret of divine values, but presents a front of perversion and contradiction, of impurity, narrowness, bondage, darkness, weakness, vileness, discord, and suffering and division, and the hideous and the crude, all that man has to leave behind in his progress. So those are all subhuman elements. Those may represent indispensable steps in developing life's possibilities upon earth, but they belong to the past, and so they have fallen into discord and division. They are forces of disintegration and retrogression. That's not what we want. Dharma is trying to make us grow larger, better. But these elements we find in us, in our society, even as still part of the universal structure. All we have to do is open our eyes and see. This is the adharma, not dharma, which strives with and seeks to overcome the dharma, to draw backward and downward the reactionary force which makes for evil, ignorance, and darkness. Between the two, there is perpetual battle and struggle, oscillation of victory and defeat, in which sometimes the upward and sometimes the downward forces prevail. This has been typified in the Vedic image of the struggle between the divine and the titanic powers, the sons of the light, and the undivided infinity, and the children of the darkness and division. In Zoroastrianism by Ahura Mazda and Ahriman, and in later religions in the contest between God and his angels and Satan or Iblis and his demons for the possession of human life and the human soul. So the struggle that we see in the world today is still very much a contest between these competing agencies, one that wants to evolve towards light and the other that says, no, you're moving too quickly and I will not give up my empire. You'll have to pry it from my cold, dead hands. It is these things that condition and determine the work of the avatar. In the Buddhistic formula, the disciple takes refuge from all that opposes his liberation in three powers, the Dharma, the Sangha, the Buddha. So in Christianity, we have the law of Christian living, the Church, and the Christ. These three are always the necessary elements of the work of the avatar. He gives a dharma, a law of self-discipline, by which to grow out of the lower into the higher life, and which necessarily includes a rule of action and of relations with our fellow men and other beings, endeavor in the Eightfold Path or the Law of Faith, Love, and Purity, or any other such revelation of the nature of the divine in life. Then, because every tendency in man has its collective as well as its individual aspect, because those who follow one way are naturally drawn together into spiritual companionship and unity, he establishes the Sangha, the fellowship and union of those whom his personality and his teaching unite. In Vaishnavism, there is the same trio, Bhagavata, Bhakta, Bhagavan. The Bhagavata, which is the law of the Vaishnava dispensation of adoration and love, the bhakta, representing the fellowship of those in whom that law is manifest. Bhagavan, the divine lover and beloved, in whose being and nature the divine law of love is founded and fulfills itself. The avatar represents this third element, the divine personality, nature, and being, who is the soul of the Dharma and the Sangha, informs them with himself, keeps them living, and draws men towards the felicity and the liberation. And we can note that when the avatar is not felt to be present, then you have a mere instruction. You have a mere conventional society. If you don't feel the inner throb, the presence of that great exemplar who not only instructs, but fills you with the power of his own being, which is cognate with the powers in your being, then it will not work. That path will not flourish. That society will not flower. In the teaching of the Gita, which is more Catholic and complex than other specialized teachings and disciplines, these things assume a larger meaning. For the unity here is the all-embracing Vedantic unity by which the soul sees all in itself and itself in all, and makes itself one with all beings. The Dharma is therefore the taking up of all human relations into a higher divine meaning. Starting from the established ethical, social, and religious rule which binds together the whole community in which the God-seeker lives, it lifts it up by informing it with the Brahmic consciousness. The law it gives is the law of oneness, of equality, of liberated, desireless, God-governed action, of God-knowledge and self-knowledge, enlightening and drawing to itself all the nature and all the action, drawing it towards divine being and divine consciousness, and of God-love as the supreme power and crown of the knowledge and the action. The idea of companionship and mutual aid in God-love and God-seeking, which is at the basis of the idea of the Sangha or divine fellowship, is brought in when the Gita speaks of the seeking of God through love and adoration. But the real Sangha of this teaching is all humanity. The whole world is moving towards this Dharma, each man according to his capacity. It is my path that men follow in every way. That's 4.11. And that's Mama Vartma in Sanskrit. And the God-seeker, making himself one with all, making their joy and sorrow and all their life his own, the liberated, made already oneself with all beings, lives in the life of humanity, lives for the one self in humanity, for God in all beings, acts for loka sangraha, for the maintaining of all in their dharma, and the Dharma, for the maintenance of their growth in all its stages and in all its paths towards the divine. So again, this is restoring Dharma to something of cosmic magnificence, united all in one, one in all, There is only one, after all. We speak of loka sangraha not as an act of gratuitous help to another, but because to hold the world together is what we do. An awakened soul does it naturally. No great being will leave the earth permanently and abandon the cosmos to sit shielded by moksha from the disturbances of the world. They will refresh themselves, energize, remind their deepest soul of what they are, and restored to integrity, come back again and join the lists. Act for Loka Sangraha, that's chapter 7, shlokas 21 through 25. For the avatar here, though he is manifest in the name and form of Krishna, lays no exclusive stress on this one form of his human birth, but on that which it represents, the divine, the Purushottama, of whom all avatars are the human births, of whom all forms and names of the Godhead worshipped by men are the figures. So the Purushottama is not enclosed and captured in one manifestation. None of the ten. And the tenth has not come, can fulfill, can completely exhaust the endless possibilities of this divine person. Each is a way and a step and an empowerment of its own. The way declared by Krishna here is indeed announced as the way by which man can reach the real knowledge and the real liberation. But it is one that is inclusive of all paths and not exclusive. For the divine takes up into his universality all avatars and all teachings and all dharmas. This is where the Gita steps outside bondage to any particular creed or religion. This is a teaching for the larger world, not simply for one corner, even of India, the north of India where Krishna grew up. This message was not simply for the people of that region. This is a message that is universal in its appeal. The Gita lays stress upon the struggle of which the world is the theater in its two aspects, the inner struggle and the outer battle. In the inner struggle, the enemies are within, in the individual, and the slaying of desire, ignorance, egoism is the victory. But there is an outer struggle between the powers of the dharma and the adharma in the human collectivity. The former is supported by the divine, the godlike nature in man, and by those who represent it or strive to realize it in human life. The latter by the titanic or demoniac, the asuric and rakshasic nature, whose head is the violent egoism, and by those who represent and strive to satisfy it. This is the war of the gods and titans, the symbol of which the old Indian literature is full. This struggle of the Mahabharata, of which Krishna is the central figure, being often represented in that image. The Pandavas who fight for the establishment of the kingdom of the Dharma are the sons of the gods. their powers in human form. Their adversaries are incarnations of the titanic powers. They are asuras. This outer struggle, too, the Avatar comes to aid, directly or indirectly, to destroy the reign of the asuras, the evildoers, and in them depress the power they represent, and to restore the oppressed ideals of the Dharma. He comes to bring nearer the kingdom of heaven on earth in the collectivity, as well as to build the kingdom of heaven within in the individual human soul. So the work is manifold. There is the restoration of cosmic order, working in the peoples of humanity, often to affect that, and then there is the work within to establish new possibilities, to restore spiritual life to its utmost power, to advance. The inner fruit of the Avatar's coming is gained by those who learn from it the true nature of the divine birth and the divine works, and who, growing full of him in their consciousness and taking refuge in him with their whole being, man maya mam upashrita, purified by the realizing force of their knowledge and delivered from the lower nature, attain to the divine being and divine nature, madbhavam. That's 4:10, that phrase above. The Avatar comes to reveal the divine nature in man, above this lower nature, and to show what are the divine works, free, unegoistic, disinterested, impersonal, universal, full of the divine light, the divine power, and the divine love. He comes as the divine personality, which shall fill the consciousness of the human being and replace the limited egoistic personality, so that it shall be liberated out of ego into infinity and universality, out of birth into immortality. He comes as the divine power and love, which calls men to itself, so that they may take refuge in that and no longer in the insufficiency of their human wills and the strife of their human fear, wrath, and passion. And liberated from all this unquiet and suffering, may live in the calm and bliss of the divine. And there's a footnote, two shlokas, and these are from chapter 4, shloka 9, shloka 10. And then at the end of this section, he's going to quote from shloka 11, same chapter. So we'll just read his translation of it all when we get to the bottom. Nor does it matter essentially in what form and name or putting forward what aspect of the divine he comes, for in all ways, varying with their nature, men are following the path set to them by the divine, which will in the end lead them to him, and the aspect of him which suits their nature is that which they can best follow when he comes to lead them. In whatever way men accept, love, and take joy in God, in that way God accepts, loves, and takes joy in man. Ye yata mam prapadyante tams tataiva bhajamyaham. So, chapter 4. Shlokas 9 through 11, as Sri Aurobindo translated them. And some of this is above, a couple of chapters ago, in the possibility and purpose of avatarhood, these translations. He who knoweth thus, in its right principles, my divine birth and my divine work, When he abandons his body, comes not to rebirth. He comes to me, O Arjuna. Delivered from liking and fear and wrath, full of me, taking refuge in me. Many, purified by austerity of knowledge, have arrived at my nature of being, Madhbhavam. As men approach me, so I accept them to my love. Men follow in every way my path. So, wonderful conclusion to that chapter, and we'll go on to the next week. It might be interesting to think of the fact that we're moving along rapidly in the first series in Essays on the Gita, and there is a second series, a part one and a part two. But we may take a pause after having gone through such lengthy reading and undertake some other work after we've done with the first series. So be in touch with us, and we'll discuss among ourselves what we want to do, how we might usefully engage ourselves on these Sunday evenings. And I want to read a section to you now from Savitri. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. And we're going to start on page 80, towards the bottom. In a divine retreat from mortal thought, in a prodigious gesture of soul sight, his being towered into pathless heights, naked of its vesture of humanity. As thus it rose, to meet him bare and pure, a strong descent leaped down, a might, a flame, a beauty half visible with deathless eyes, a violent ecstasy, a sweetness dire, enveloped him with its stupendous limbs, and penetrated nerve and heart and brain, that thrilled and fainted with the epiphany. His nature shuddered in the unknown's grasp. In a moment shorter than death, longer than time, by a power more ruthless than love, happier than heaven, taken sovereignly into eternal arms, hailed and coerced by a stark absolute bliss, in a whirlwind circuit of delight and force, hurried into unimaginable depths, upborne into immeasurable heights, it was torn out from its mortality and underwent a new and bornless change. An omniscient knowing without sight or thought, an indecipherable omnipotence, a mystic form that could contain the worlds, yet make one human breast its passionate shrine, drew him out of his seeking loneliness into the magnitudes of God's embrace. As when a timeless eye annuls the hours, abolishing the agent and the act, so now his spirit shone out wide, blank, pure. His wakened mind became an empty slate on which the universal and soul could write. All that represses our fallen consciousness was taken from him like a forgotten load. A fire that seemed the body of a god consumed the limiting figures of the past and made large room for a new self to live. Eternity's contact broke the molds of sense. A greater force than the earthly held his limbs. huge workings, bared his undiscovered sheaths. Strange energies wrought and screened tremendous hands, unwound the triple cord of mind, and freed the heavenly wideness of a Godhead's gaze. As through a dress the wearer's shape is seen, there reached through forms to the hidden absolute a cosmic feeling and transcendent sight. Increased and heightened were the instruments. It's a good place to end. And when you reflect upon Sri Aurobindo's life, you'll see that this aptly describes the descent of Krishna as the Anandamaya into his frame. Huh. Go back and reread it. It's beautiful. As are you, and I look forward to seeing you again. It'll be a gift to me, throwing rapture into my lap. And we have a new image that we want to offer on Sunday nights, which we'll show you next week as we open our session with Mother's Music. And again, as always, thanks to our dear Deborah Booth for playing that music for us, and to Navaja for offering the image that ignites our aspiration and enlivens our souls. Grateful to you all for all that you do. Namaste. Jai Ma.